పరిమళిస్తుంది అన్న రీతిలో చదువుకునే స్థాయిలోనే చిప్ డిజైనింగ్లో ప్రపంచ ఖ్యాతిని ఆర్జించిన యంగ్ సైంటిస్ట్ అర్పణ జనగా ఈరోజు మన గెస్ట్ అవర్ అతిథి. హలో అర్పణ.
హాయ్.
చదువుకునే స్థాయిలో
When she was just 21 years old, Arpana Janaga entered an engineering competition run by a technology company called Microchip. Contestants had to use an electronics kit provided by the company to design an original piece of hardware. The winner got 15 grand, second place got 7,500, and so on. Thousands of people entered. Arpana was one of the runners-up and the only one from Asia. She built an advanced communications jammer, a device essentially that disrupted radio and cell waves. Placing in the U.S. contest made Arpana something of a celebrity in Hyderabad, and the next spring she appeared on a local TV broadcast to talk about her invention.
It was like a mixture of two different chips. ఇంతవరకు ఏమయ్యేదంటే రెండు కొనుక్కుని రెండిట్తో.
Arpana and the host also discussed religion, science fiction, and Arpana's own writing.
And poetry, small poems, like just to express yourself.
Near the end of the interview at the Hyderabad TV station, Arpana agreed to perform one of her favorite ballads, a famous Bollywood love song.
Ehsaan tera ho ga mujh par dil chahta hai jo kehne do mujhe tumse mohabbat ho gayi hai mujhe aankhon ki chhaav mein.
Even in death it goes, I will sing your praises. Flying around, the ashes will say, let me bear the burdens of love. In early November of 2008, there was a memorial service for Arpana at a funeral home in Bellevue. Her friends had put together a photo montage and it played on a projector screen. The room was packed with residents of the Valley View, with Arpana's friends from the motorcycle club, and with buddies like Rachel Shout.
For a young woman to have barely lived here and have, you know, that many people love her already in that short amount of time she was here, it's very profound.
Rachel made her way to the front of the room and dropped a rose into the open casket. Wandering back outside, she was struck by a strange sensation, something she couldn't fully shake, no matter how hard she tried.
You know, I've watched a lot of Investigation Discovery, sadly, and it's like, did the person who did it show up? It could be somebody here. There are those sick people out there that do that.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Suspect. This is episode 3, Persons of Interest.
Committed to complete Northwest news coverage, Cairo 7 Eyewitness News starts right now.
There is international concern tonight over the murder of a woman on the east side. Flowers and candles have been placed outside the Redmond apartment where Arpina Janaga was found strangled on Monday. Investigators admit right now they don't know who killed her or why.
It's hard to say whether it was somebody she knew or didn't know, and that's why we're going to continue on talking to as many people as we can.
Within a week of Arpina's murder, police had tracked down nearly everyone who'd been at the Halloween party at the Valley View. One by one, they were brought in for interviews and asked to give DNA samples. It made residents like Chris Cutler, the guy who'd been dressed up as Jesus, very uncomfortable, to say the least. After all, it was one thing to have your apartment complex turned into an active crime scene, and it was another to face the possibility that the same person or people who had killed Arpina Janaga were still living at the Valley View, still going about their normal business.
Very nervous. We were all on edge. Nobody knew who they could trust or who, you know, what had really gone down. Immediately, we were all talking through the whole party and what had happened. Like over the next couple of days, whenever we'd be out smoking, of course, that was the only real topic of convo.
Making matters even more complicated for Chris was that police seemed to be looking hard at his stepbrother, Neil, the arm wrestler who'd gotten very drunk that night.
It just seemed like the police were doggedly going after him because he was an outsider who had come to the place and then didn't have any alibi between whatever time he left and when he got home.
Well, sort of. In reality, the alibi was only part of it. In their interviews with residents of the Valley View and attendees of the Halloween party, Detective Brian Coates and his colleagues at the Redmond Police Department, they'd repeatedly asked, who triggered alarm bells in your head? Who might be good for this? They almost always got the same answer. Neil.
Yeah, the first person everybody was pointing fingers at, you know, hitting on all the women, being frankly an ass, decides he's going to go leave, kind of gets all pissed off and walks 3 hours to get to his house. You know, it's kind of weird. We got to look into this guy.
On a recent trip to Seattle, I called up Neil on his cell. I'd hoped to meet in person, but it turned out Neil had just moved down to San Diego. So we spoke by phone instead with Neil on speaker.
So tell us about, what do you remember of the party?
I don't know how long of a podcast you've got going on there. This could be like a whole 8-hour sort of experience.
Neil confirmed the basic outline of the night. He arrived with his stepbrother, Chris Cutler. He arm wrestled with Emmanuel, the guy had been dressed as a construction worker. And yeah, he had jabbed Emmanuel in the lip, but it was all in good fun. Later, Neil said, Arpina had invited him into her bedroom.
She was very suggestive in her, let's go to my room and take a look at my bed. I mean, it's kind of hard to interpret that a different way. But, you know, the second that we did that, he came into the room and said, hey, let's hang out, you know.
The he here, the guy who came into the room, is Cameron Johnson, Arpina's next door neighbor. The guy in the devil mask. The guy who had found Arpina's body.
And I always thought that was, this is very, very fucking crass, what I'm about to say, but that's kind of what's called a cock block. At the time, I considered it that. I considered him to be jealous that he didn't want her to be with some other person.
Neil told us that that was the sum total of his experience with Arpina. He'd been around her that evening, yes. He'd gone into her room briefly with her, but Cameron had come in and Neil had left. and later he'd walked home a distance of more than 7 miles. At 4 a.m., he'd stopped for cigarettes at a convenience store where he was captured on film at the register. A couple hours later, Neil was at home, in bed, asleep, which his family confirmed to police. Before Neil hung up, I asked him if he often thought about the case. And it was here that, for the first time, real anger entered his voice.
The only time I think about it is when, like, people like you fucking try to contact me and remind me of it. And just the fact that it's taken 12 years. And, you know, look, I didn't do anything. I just want this shit to be over. So I figured, you know, I'm going to take this guy's call. I'll talk to him about the podcast, and maybe that'll be it. That'll be the last of it, that I ever have to hear about this ever again. But I don't know. So I'm just trying to tell my side of it, as incoherent as it is, because it's been so long, and maybe placate you, placate the family, because it's not my place to keep people from knowing everything they need to know. Can you please do me a favor? Mm-hmm. Don't cut my shit to make me look bad. I'm just trying to tell the truth, what I know, my perspective, okay? Don't fucking cut this podcast in a way that makes me look like some sort of maybe suspect. Because I'm not, dude. It's not me. I just walked away that night. That's it.
Soon after the murder, Detective Brian Coates received some preliminary results from the medical examiner. They showed that Arpana had died of asphyxia. She'd been strangled, essentially, probably with some kind of ligature, a string or a rope or a length of cloth. In a full report a month later, the examiner revealed more. There were bruises across Arpana's torso and legs, and she had a broken tooth. It all suggested she'd fought back. Not long ago, I spoke to Aaron Gertler, the motorcyclist who'd been hooking up with Arpana in 2008. Aaron was quick to argue that the killer must have been big, must have been strong, because Arpana was extremely strong herself.
I think at that time, I was 5'8 and 140 pounds. The likelihood of me being able to inflict the injuries on her that she sustained is pretty low. I mean, realistically pretty low. To be able to, I don't know if you want me to go into too much detail.
You can, if you feel comfortable with it.
Well, if she were strangled to death, beaten, that takes a lot more force than most people think. It's not like movies.
Aaron was later brought in for an interview with the Redmond PD. He hadn't attended the party, but his alibi on the morning of November 1st was not particularly strong. He'd come home from a bar and gone to bed, alone. Plus, forensic tests would later show that Aaron's semen was on a towel found at the crime scene, and his DNA was on a bedsheet. Aaron did have an explanation. Arpana had modeled the Little Red Riding Hood costume for him, and they'd had sex. They were 20-somethings in the early stages of a new romance, so not particularly surprising. Aaron stressed to me that he'd opened up his life for detectives. He'd sat for multiple interviews, saw his attorney, and he had provided a DNA swab.
And just to be clear, you told the police, I did not do this.
Of course, yeah. I said that there's no way I could have harmed her. I did not do anything to harm her. I did not kill her. It's unfathomable. Unfathomable. Ugh, sorry. I couldn't even imagine harming her or another human being. It's not something that I would do.
Ultimately, detectives did move on, although not before asking Aaron if he had any suspicions of his own.
Does any part of you think that someone from the motorcycle group could have been involved in this?
Oh, for certain. Yeah, all of these people in the group, they're people off the internet. You don't know anyone truly, unless you're really good friends with them, maybe. you meet on a bike night and you invite them over to your house and you assume that they're safe because they're part of the community. But we all know in real life that's not true. I mean, you're not safe anywhere. That's not how life works.
He's right. The police did look at the PNW Riders membership, just like they looked at all the males in Arpana's orbit. Although a rape kit had come back negative, the fact that the victim was naked, the fact that her tampon had been removed, the fact that there was bruising to her upper thighs, all suggested that there had been a sexual component to the crime. In fact, years later, when they finally obtained an indictment in the case, that's how prosecutors would charge it. Murder with sexual motivation. For now, police were looking for men who might have had the motive to target Arpana. Maybe a man she'd turned down in the past, or maybe it was a sexual encounter that had started consensually, then turned violent.
As we're interviewing everybody who lived at the Valley View, you know, we're asking about the various relationships, who knew who was dating who. Who was friends, and he was just crossing people off the list.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling T-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
There's this thing that happens on fictional shows like Law & Order, where the person who discovers a murder scene, the poor schmo stumbles upon a body in Central Park or in a misty alley off Broadway, comes in for a lot of extra questioning. Real cops do this too, and for good reason.
It's the most pure sense of what happened. The first observation, witness testimony to what the scene looked like before anybody else had entered it. It's an important piece of any investigation because why did that person find the body? Why were they in the apartment to find the body? What did they see?
In other words, the person who reports a crime or the person who's on hand when the police arrive may have some kind of connection to it.
When the investigation gets to be a little bit longer in the tooth, you start looking back at that first conversation and comparing what was said at that point with the evidence you've uncovered subsequently and through additional interviews, conversations with the same person, because what we're looking for is consistency. And if there is any inconsistency, you have to ask the question, is somebody lying to conceal something that they didn't want to tell us?
Brian Coates' first interview with Cameron Johnson, Arpana's neighbor, the guy who wore the devil mask at the party, had taken place on November 3rd, shortly after Cameron and Jay had found Arpana's body. It was a cursory interview, less than 30 minutes. But since then, some new information had come to light.
What we noticed through this preliminary investigation was that Cameron Johnson, based on his phone records, called Arpana two times around the 3 o'clock hour. And he never mentioned that to me during our first interview with him. So we thought that was pretty interesting.
Cameron was invited back to the Redmond Police Department, where he sat down at a table with Brian Coates and his partner, Detective Ron Harding.
Okay, this is Detective Brian Coates. I'm in an interview with Cameron Johnson. It is November 3rd, 2008 at 11:15 hours. This interview is involving case number 08-020331. We are just off the lobby of the Redmond Public Safety Building. Cameron, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Cameron reiterated to the police he'd heard some sounds coming from Arpana's apartment around 3 in the morning.
Not to be crude, we just got to ask these questions. I mean, it sounded like sex. What did you hear? Did you hear moaning? Did you hear voices?
It sounded like moaning, but I didn't hear anyone else.
What kind of moaning?
It wasn't, it was kind of muffled, but I was in a different room probably.
But now, sitting with the detectives, Cameron adds a new detail. Around the same time he'd heard the moaning, he texted an old girlfriend, Heather. He'd typed one word, yo. A booty call, he admitted.
Other than Heather, did you text or call anybody else at that hour?
Not that I know of, no. Not that I remember.
Is it possible you did?
I don't think so.
Coates and his partner know this is not the truth. They've seen Arpana's phone records. But they let it go, allow Cameron to move on, because there's more they want to ask him. As it turns out, on the morning of November 1st, not long after Arpana Janaga was strangled, Cameron Johnson had gotten into his Acura and driven 100 miles to the Canadian border.
How come?
How come I went out there?
Yeah.
I just wanted to go for a drive. Did you see that?
Do you do that often?
Yeah. It's just a direction I hadn't driven before, so.
Never been to Canada before?
A long time ago, probably. I don't remember the last time, but it was years ago. So, any friends or family that live there?
The officers at the border had clearly been suspicious. For one thing, Cameron did not have his passport with him. He left that at home. For another, he couldn't explain why exactly he wanted to enter Canada. The best he could do was he wanted to explore, to wander.
I was just kind of driving. They actually pulled me in, like, searched my car and did all that. And then at that point, I was like, okay, it's probably going to take this long if I turn around and come back in. And they were like, yeah, it's going to be dark. You're not really going to be able to explore. So I told them it probably wouldn't go more than an hour north and then come back.
Entry denied. In Cameron's telling, he'd shut the door of his car and headed back south.
What did you do after I got turned back at the border?
I came back.
Came back to Redmond?
No, my friend had texted me earlier that day, like I think around 12 or so, and said he was having a Halloween party, like an after Halloween party, like last minute, and he's up in Everett. And I went there and he had his band playing, and you know what, I don't even know what time I got to Canada, because I think I got there at 7.
So, to recap, Cameron had texted and called his ex at 3 a.m., then said he went back to sleep, woke up the next morning around 10, climbed into his car, got breakfast at Denny's, and then he'd driven to Canada to explore, only to be turned around at the border, all of which, to Coates, was highly unusual.
Of course, we talked to his close friends throughout the investigation, his parents, who all confirmed, yeah, that's Cameron. When something's on his mind, you know, he'll go for a long drive. And then, of course, we're thinking, well, if you just killed somebody, that would be on your mind. It might prompt a long drive.
Weirder still, that night, Cameron had sustained a leg injury, and it was the type of injury, police theorized, that one might get in the course of an assault on a woman who was training in martial arts. Arpana was learning Taekwondo. Cameron did have an explanation for the injury, but it was a puzzling one. He said he'd done some wrestling with a friend of a friend.
Who did you get in the wrestling match with? Who was that?
His name was David.
What's his last name?
I don't know. I just met him that night.
You're wrestling around the guy you just met? You do that often?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Have you seen a doctor yet for your knee?
No, my little brother's in, he's going to school for physical therapy, and he's like, I'll just wait a couple days, and if it heals, don't worry about it. So, and it's better now, so.
Is that the only thing that got hurt?
I smashed my elbow on the cement, too. We fell over and I hit.
This was outside, you guys were wrestling around?
We set up a little tarp out there and kind of didn't even, we had just started and we kind of walked off the tarp and then we both went for a takedown at the same time and I landed on the cement, smashed my elbow.
Gradually, Coates circles back to the night of Arpana's murder and Cameron's call to Arpana, which, remember, Cameron had originally claimed occurred later in the morning.
Why did you call her then? Just see how she was doing.
Check in with her?
Yeah.
I think that's what you told me last time we talked, is it was after you got up, we were thinking 10 o'clock, 11, and you called just to check up on her, see how she was doing?
Yeah.
Is that what you remember doing?
That's what I remember. I don't know. Would have been like a phone call. Like I didn't really think anything after I called her and then didn't get a response and didn't really think about it after that.
Did something happen? I think I asked you before about a romantic relationship.
We never had anything like that. Nothing happened between us.
Fine, Coates says. But the night of the party, how did Arpana look?
I mean, she was dressed, showing off her stuff, so.
Coates decides to pounce. He explains to Cameron that they can figure out quite easily when those calls were placed and to whom. Maybe he could just take a peek at Cameron's phone to save him the trouble.
I asked him if I could look at it, and he said sure. I went through the phone logs and showed him the entry that showed that he attempted to call Arpana at 2:57 in the morning. And then again at 3:03 in the morning. And when I showed him that, without hesitating and spontaneously, he said, oh, crap.
You home from high school? Looks like you called her at 3:02.
Yeah.
And 2:56.
You don't remember that? Mm-hmm. So you called her twice that night.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Which was the time you kind of heard maybe heard the sex noises?
Yeah.
But you don't remember calling her?
Mm-hmm. Were you really out of it when you woke up at that hour? You weren't that drunk, and you were alert enough to hear the noises.
Yeah,
the store.
I don't know. I don't remember. It was just kind of a blur.
Why would that be?
I don't know.
A pattern starts to emerge. Coates and his partner push. Cameron essentially throws up his hands, shrugs.
And at this point, the interview gets really painstakingly frustrating because we'll ask him if he remembered calling, and he'll say no. Well, if she didn't answer, did you go next door and try to knock on the door and contact her? And his answer was always, I don't think so. I don't remember.
Still, Coates and Harding feel they're on the verge of something, and they quickly Mirandize Cameron.
Because we were kind of going down that path and we were starting to think, this might lead to a confession any minute now. Let's get him advised of his constitutional rights.
Cameron signs the form and the detectives pick up where they left off.
Is it a worry or a concern in your mind that something happened there between you and Arpana that you're not remembering?
I don't know.
Is that a possibility?
I don't know. I think for some reason may be worried about, but I don't know.
Is it, I'm just asking, and you would know, is it possible something happened that you don't really remember?
I don't think so. I don't remember anything about,
Because you got to look at this from our perspective a little bit.
The two detectives keep pushing, nudging, cajoling. Just tell us, they say. Get it over with. Get it out in the open.
And you said originally that you called her maybe around 10. Yeah. Why would you remember calling her at 10 when that didn't happen?
I have no idea. I don't know.
See how it's kind of falling apart?
Yeah.
And it's like time you just got to tell us what happened. Because and I'll just be hypothetical. My thought is that maybe even something consensual started, but it went weird.
I don't remember ever entering into her apartment or going out. We're going out, we're knocking on the door or anything. I don't think that happened.
Is it possible it could have and you don't remember it?
I don't think so.
But you know, you understand, Cameron, that I don't think so and I don't remember aren't good answers.
I know.
Finally, everything comes to a head for both the detectives and for Cameron.
I'm telling you everything.
You're not.
I'm telling you.
Because the way you're telling us is telling me that you're holding stuff back. Did you kick in her door?
No, I didn't kick.
That's where I'm telling you to come clean right now and tell the truth.
I didn't.
Because the thing you're trying to carry around with you is going to tear you apart. You can't hold on to something like that, man.
Can we turn this off?
You want to turn it off?
I just want to talk.
Go ahead. We just got to record the time.
I just
got to
do some official stuff here. It's 16:07 hours on 11:508. Or turn off the tape recorder, the request of Mr. Johnson.
Now, I have a different piece of tape I want to play you. Like the one you just heard, where Cameron Johnson is being grilled by Redmond detectives, it's an interview tape, which we obtained through a public records request. But this tape was recorded years later, in 2016, and this time, Brian Coates is on the receiving end of the questioning. His interrogator is a Seattle public defender named Ben Goldsmith.
Okay, it's 11:09. We've restarted the recorders. Lieutenant Coates, are you still giving your permission to be recorded?
Yes.
In the tape, Goldsmith returns to Coates' interrogation of Cameron Johnson, and more specifically, to the way the exchange had ended.
So at some point, at the end of this interview, Mr. Johnson basically asked to turn off the recorder. Is that right?
That's what I recall.
He says, can we turn this off? And Detective Harding says, sure. And Cameron says, I just want to talk. What did he want to talk about after the recorder was off?
I don't recall. I don't think he said much of anything.
But the attorney, Ben Goldsmith, was not going to let Coates off that easily.
Okay.
If he did, it would have been documented in her reports.
Okay. If he had said anything important.
Yeah, off the record, I killed her or something like that? You know, no.
Right.
If it was really anything at all, we would have documented it. And I don't know what Detective Harding put in his report. I didn't review it prior to today.
Right. How did Mr. Johnson, I assume he didn't stay at the police station. He obviously wasn't arrested. What happened after that recorder got turned off?
He was released and walked out the door.
Okay. Was he a suspect at that point?
Yes.
Was there any other suspect at that point?
Nope.
If the first decision to allow Cameron Johnson, your primary suspect, to go off the record at a crucial juncture is unusual, it's this next decision that really stands out. Because when Cameron Johnson did leave the Redmond Police Department on November 5th, he was permitted to take his BlackBerry with him. The same phone he'd used to call Arpana right before her murder. By the time the Redmond Police Department did get possession of that device again, someone had scrubbed some of the texts and call data from it, including the potentially crucial data from Halloween weekend. I asked Coates about this when we spoke this past summer, and all he could say was, yeah, the BlackBerry thing was a mistake.
There were some things we wished we would have done. Taking the phone was one of them, which we chose not to, and don't ask me why at the point.
I don't know why we didn't.
In early November of 2008, Redmond detectives executed a search warrant on Cameron's apartment and on his SUV, an Acura MDX. Inside the vehicle, they found a printout.
And that was a map showing a bunch of pawn shops in the east side, Puget Sound area. The timestamp was printed the morning of November 1st. I thought that was particularly interesting because we knew at the time that Arpana's cell phone and her digital camera was missing from the apartment, presumably stolen by the suspects. So we looked at that pawn search as something to really dig into, because if he pawned those particular items, it would be a slam dunk. But as we found out, nothing was easy in this case.
Coates couldn't find any mention of Cameron or the missing items in a database of local pawn shop sales. Worse yet, for the purposes of the Redmond PD, Cameron quickly obtained the services of a white shoe defense firm in Seattle. His November 5th interview with Coates turned out to be the last useful one he gave. After that, all further interactions between Cameron and the cops had to be conducted in the presence of Cameron's attorneys. So, by mid-November, the Redmond PD had found itself temporarily stalled out. They had no smoking guns, and without the phone, nothing of forensic value. They did have circumstantial evidence, but a good attorney would be able to help Cameron dance around it.
Nobody saw him commit the murder. The road trip could be explained away. A lot of these things can be explained away, so that's why there was no decision to charge until there was more physical evidence directly linking somebody to the crime scene. Now, of course, we amongst our detectives had varying opinions to Cameron's responsibility. Some thought, you know, this is the right person. Others were, yeah, I don't know. Don't think so. Let's keep looking.
And it was while they were looking that a new person of interest emerged. A person with a substantial criminal record, an unsatisfying explanation for his actions on the night of the murder, a person who happened to have a warrant out for his arrest. That's next time on Suspect.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Campside and Wondery, this is episode 3 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Judd Caswell at Frog Hollow Studio in Topsom, Maine. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Jen Sargent. You're about to hear a preview of 912. While you're listening, make sure to follow 912 on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I'm Dan Taberski. Do you want to hear my 9/11 story? Yeah, me neither. Because what I want to talk about is what happened on 9/12 and every day after that.
This morning, less than 24 hours later, the signature of the New York skyline is no more.
9/12 is a documentary podcast about how we turned 9/11 the day into 9/11 the idea, and how that idea was used to shape the next 20 years.
1 year ago today, we remember what the terrorists wrought.
9/11 became a call to arms.
Plane crashes. I say I'm going to join the military. Another plane crashes.
5 years ago, America was a nation at peace.
9/11 became a dangerous joke to tell.
I eventually came up with the headline of Nation Vows to Defeat Whoever It Is We're at War With.
It's when conspiracy sprouted. The original super spreader before all that came since.
Everything that's happening now is bananas. Like, Sandy Hook is bananas, Flat Earth is bananas, QAnon is bananas. Oh yeah, how convenient that you think all those other conspiracy theories are bananas, but you don't think your own pet theory is bananas. First of all, I don't know what happened on 9/11.
How much of who we are now is because of what happened then, on that day 20 years ago? And do we finally have enough distance to see it clearly? Follow 9/12 wherever you get your podcasts, or you can binge all 7 episodes right now on Amazon Music or with Wondery Plus.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.